To his great surprise, Hermione did not appear either excited or intrigued by the news. On the contrary, her face fell, and she bit her lip.
"What's the matter with you?"
said Ron.
"I don't know," said Hermione slowly. "But it's a bit odd, isn't it? I mean, this is supposed to be quite a good broom, isn't it?"
Ron sighed exasperatedly. "It's the best broom there is, Hermione," he said.
"So it must have been really expensive."
"Probably cost more than all the Slytherin brooms put together," said Ron happily.
"Well, who'd send Harry something as expensive as that, and not even tell him they'd sent it?"
said Hermione.
"Who cares?" said Ron impatiently. "Listen, Harry, can I have a go on it? Can I?"
"I don't think anyone should ride that broom just yet," said Hermione shrilly. Harry and Ron looked at her.
"What do you think Harry's going to do with it? Sweep the floor?" said Ron.
But before Hermione could answer, Crookshank sprang from Seamus's bed, right at Ron's chest.
"Get him out of here!"
Ron bellowed as Crookshank's claws ripped his pyjamas and Scabbers attempted a wild escape over his shoulder. Ron seized Scabbers by the tail and aimed a misjudged kick at Crookshank's that hit the trunk at the end of Harry's bed, knocking it over and causing Ron to hop up and down, howling with pain. Crookshank's fur suddenly stood on end. A shrill, tinny whistling was filling the room. The pocket sneakerscope had become dislodged from Uncle Vernon's old socks and was whirling and gleaming on the floor.
"I forgot about that,"
Harry said, bending down and picking up the sneakerscope. "I never wear those socks if I can help it." The sneakerscope whirled and whistled in his palm. Crookshank's was hissing and spitting at it.
"You'd better take that cat out of here, Hermione," said Ron furiously, sitting on Harry's bed, nursing his toe. "Can't you shut that thing up?"
he added to Harry as Hermione strode out of the room. Crookshank's yellow eyes still fixed maliciously on Ron. Harry stuffed the sneakerscope back inside the socks and threw it back into his trunk. All that could be heard now were Ron's stifled moans of pain and rage. Scabbers was huddled in Ron's hands. It had been a while since Harry had seen him out of Ron's pocket, and he was unpleasantly surprised to see that Scabbers, once so fat, was now very skinny. Patches of fur seemed to have fallen out, too.
"He's not looking too good, is he?" Harry said.
"It's stress," said Ron. "He'd be fine if that big stupid furball left him alone." But Harry, remembering what the woman at the magical menagerie had said about rats living only 3 years, couldn't help feeling that unless Scabbers had powers he had never revealed, he was reaching the end of his life. And despite Ron's frequent complaints that Scabbers was both boring and useless, he was sure Ron would be very miserable if Scabbers died. Christmas spirit was definitely thin on the ground in the Gryffindor common room that morning. Hermione had shut Crookshanks in her dormitory, but was furious with Ron for trying to kick him. Ron was still fuming about Crookshanks's fresh attempt to eat Scabbers. Harry gave up trying to make them talk to each other and devoted himself to examining the firebolt, which he had brought down to the common room with him. For some reason, this seemed to annoy Hermione as well. She didn't say anything, but she kept looking darkly at the broom as though it too had been criticizing her cat. At lunchtime, they went down to the great hall to find that the house tables had been moved against the walls again, and that a single table set for 12 stood in the middle of the room. Professors Dumbledore, McGonagall, Snape, Sprout, and Flitwick were there, along with Filch, the caretaker, who had taken off his usual brown coat and was wearing a very old and rather mouldy-looking tailcoat. There were only 3 other students, 2 extremely nervous-looking first years and a sullen-faced Slytherin fifth year.
"Merry Christmas!" said Dumbledore, as Harry, Ron, and Hermione approached the table. "As there are so few of us, it seemed foolish to use the house tables. Sit down, sit down."
Harry, Ron, and Hermione sat down side by side at the end of the table.
"Crackers!"
said Dumbledore enthusiastically, offering the end of a large silver noisemaker to Snape, who took it reluctantly and tugged. With a bang, like a gunshot, the cracker flew apart to reveal a large, pointed witch's hat topped with a stuffed vulture. Harry, remembering the boggart, caught Ron's eye and they both grinned. Snape's mouth thinned and he pushed the hat towards Dumbledore, who swapped it for his wizard's hat at once.
"Dig in!" he advised the table, beaming around. As Harry was helping himself to roast potatoes, the doors of the great hall opened again. It was Professor Trelawney, gliding toward them as though on wheels. She had put on a green sequin dress in honor of the occasion, making her look more than ever like a glittering, oversized dragonfly. "Sybil, this is a pleasant surprise," said Dumbledore, standing up.
"I have been crystal-gazing, Headmaster," said Professor Trelawney in her mistiest, most faraway voice, "and to my astonishment, I saw myself abandoning my solitary luncheon and coming to join you. Who am I to refuse the promptings of fate? I at once hastened from my tower, and I do beg you to forgive my lateness."
"Certainly, certainly," said Dumbledore, his eyes twinkling. "Let me draw you up a chair." And he did indeed draw a chair in midair with his wand, which revolved for a few seconds before falling with a thud between Professor Snape and McGonagall. Professor Trelawney, however, did not sit down. Her enormous eyes had been roving around the table, and she suddenly uttered a kind of soft scream.
"I dare not, Headmaster. If I join the table, we shall be 13. Nothing could be more unlucky. Never forget that when 13 dine together, the first to rise will be the first to die."
"We'll risk it, Sybil," said Professor McGonagall impatiently. "Do sit down. The turkey's getting stone cold." Professor Trelawney hesitated, then lowered herself into the empty chair, eyes shut and mouth clenched tight, as though expecting a thunderbolt to hit the table. Professor McGonagall poked a large spoon into the nearest tureen.
"Tripe, Sybil!"
Professor Trelawney ignored her. Eyes open again, she looked around once more and said,
"But where is dear Professor Lupin?"
"I'm afraid the poor fellow is ill again," said Dumbledore, indicating that everybody should start serving themselves. "Most unfortunate that it should happen on Christmas Day."
"But surely you already knew that, Sybil,"
said Professor McGonagall, her eyebrows raised. Professor Trelawney gave Professor McGonagall a very cold look.
"Certainly I knew, Minerva," she said quietly, "but one does not parade the fact that one is all-knowing. I frequently act as though I'm not possessed of the inner eye, so as not to make others nervous."
"That explains a great deal," said Professor McGonagall tartly. Professor Trelawney's voice suddenly became a good deal less misty.
"If you must know, Minerva, I have seen that poor Professor Lupin will not be with us for very long. He seems aware himself that his time is short. He positively fled when I offered to crystal gaze for him."
"Imagine that," said Professor McGonagall dryly. "I doubt," said Dumbledore, in a cheerful but slightly raised voice, which put an end to Professor McGonagall and Professor Trelawney's conversation, "that Professor Lupin is in any immediate danger. Severus, you've made the potion for him again?"
"Yes, Headmaster," said Snape.
"Good," said Dumbledore. "Then he should be up and about in no time. Derek, have you had any of these chipolatas? They're excellent." The first-year boy went furiously red on being addressed directly by Dumbledore and took the platter of sausages with trembling hands. Professor Trelawney behaved almost normally until the very end of Christmas dinner, 2 hours later. Full to bursting with Christmas dinner, and still wearing their party hats, Harry and Ron got up first from the table, and she shrieked loudly.
"My dears, which of you left his seat first? Which?"
"Dunno," said Ron, looking uneasily at Harry.
"I doubt it will make much difference," said Professor McGonagall coldly, "unless a mad axeman is waiting outside the doors to slaughter the first into the entrance hall."
Even Ron laughed. Professor Trelawney looked highly affronted.
"Coming?" Harry said to Hermione.
"No,"
Hermione muttered. "I want a quick word with Professor McGonagall."
"Probably trying to see if she can take any more classes," yawned Ron, as they made their way into the entrance hall, which was completely devoid of mad axemen.
When they reached the portrait hall, they found Sir Cadogan enjoying a Christmas party with a couple of monks, several previous headmasters of Hogwarts, and his fat pony. He pushed up his visor and toasted them with a flagon of mead.
Merry Christmas! Password!
Scurvy cur, said Ron.
And the same to you, sir,
roared Sir Cadogan, as the painting swung forward to admit them. Harry went straight up to the dormitory, collected the firebolt and the broomstick servicing kit Hermione had given him for his birthday, brought them downstairs, and tried to find something to do to the firebolt. However, there were no bent twigs to clip, and the handle was so shiny already it seemed pointless to polish it. He and Ron simply sat admiring it from every angle until the portrait hole opened and Hermione came in, accompanied by Professor McGonagall. Though Professor McGonagall was head of Gryffindor House, Harry had seen her in the common room only once before, and that had been to make a very grave announcement. He and Ron stared at her, both holding the firebolt. Hermione walked around them, sat down, picked up the nearest book, and hid her face behind it.
"So that's it, is it?"
said Professor McGonagall beadily, walking over to the fireside and staring at the firebolt.
"Miss Granger has just informed me that you have been sent a broomstick, Potter."
Harry and Ron looked around at Hermione. They could see her forehead reddening over the top of her book, which was upside down.
"May I?"
said Professor McGonagall, but she didn't wait for an answer before pulling the firebolt out of their hands. She examined it carefully from handle to twig ends.
And there was no note at all, Potter? No card, no message of any kind?
No, said Harry blankly.
I see, said Professor McGonagall. Well, I'm afraid I will have to take this, Potter.
What? Said Harry, scrambling to his feet. Why?
It will need to be checked for jinxes, said Professor McGonagall. Of course, I'm no expert, but I dare say Madam Hooch and Professor Flitwick will strip it down.
Strip it down? Repeated Ron, as though Professor McGonagall was mad.
It shouldn't take more than a few weeks, said Professor McGonagall. You will have it back if we are sure it is jinx-free.
There's nothing wrong with it, said Harry, his voice shaking slightly. Honestly, Professor.
You can't know that, Potter, said Professor McGonagall, quite kindly. Not until you've flown it, at any rate, and I'm afraid that is out of the question until we are certain that it has not been tampered with. I shall keep you informed.
Professor McGonagall turned on her heel and carried the firebolt out of the portrait hole, which closed behind her. Harry stood staring after her, the tin of high finish polish still clutched in his hands. Ron, however, rounded on Hermione.
"What did you go running to McGonagall for?"
Hermione threw her book aside. She was still pink in the face, but stood up and faced Ron defiantly.
"Because I thought, and Professor McGonagall agrees with me, that that broom was probably sent to Harry by Sirius Black."
Chapter 12. The Patronus. Harry knew that Hermione had meant well, but that didn't stop him from being angry with her. He had been the owner of the best broom in the world for a few short hours, and now, because of her interference, he didn't know whether he would ever see it again. He was positive that there was nothing wrong with the firebolt now, but what sort of state would it be in once it had been subjected to all sorts of anti-jinx tests? Ron was furious with Hermione, too. As far as he was concerned, the stripping down of a brand-new firebolt was nothing less than criminal damage. Hermione, who remained convinced that she had acted for the best, started avoiding the common room. Harry and Ron supposed she had taken refuge in the library and didn't try to persuade her to come back. All in all, they were glad when the rest of the school returned shortly after New Year, and Gryffindor Tower became crowded and noisy again. Wood sought Harry out on the night before term started.
"Had a good Christmas?" he said, and then without waiting for an answer, he sat down, lowered his voice, and said, "I've been doing some thinking over Christmas, Harry. After last match, you know, if the Dementors come to the next one, I mean, we can't afford you to, well..."
Wood broke off, looking awkward.
"I'm working on it," said Harry quickly. "Professor Lupin said he'd train me to ward off the Dementors. We should be starting this week. He said he'd have time after Christmas."
"Ah," said Wood, his expression clearing.
"Well, in that case, I really didn't want to lose you as Seeker, Harry. And have you ordered a new broom yet?"
"No," said Harry.
What? You'd better get a move on, you know. You can't ride that shooting star against Ravenclaw.
He got a firebolt for Christmas, said Ron.
A firebolt? No, seriously? A real firebolt?
Don't get excited, Oliver, said Harry gloomily. I haven't got it any more. It was confiscated. And he explained all about how the firebolt was now being checked for jinxes.
Jinxed? How could it be jinxed?
Sirius Black, Harry said wearily. He's supposed to be after me, so McGonagall reckons he might have sent it. Waving aside the information that a famous murderer was after his seeker, Wood said,
But Black couldn't have bought a firebolt. He's on the run. The whole country's on the lookout for him. How could he just walk into quality Quidditch supplies and buy a broomstick?
I know, said Harry, but McGonagall still wants to strip it down. Wood went pale.
I'll go and talk to her, Harry, he promised. I'll make her see reason. A firebolt, a real firebolt on our team. She wants Gryffindor to win as much as we do. I'll make her see sense. A firebolt.
Classes started again the next day. The last thing anyone felt like doing was spending 2 hours on the grounds on a raw January morning, but Hagrid had provided a bonfire full of salamanders for their enjoyment, and they spent an unusually good lesson collecting dry wood and leaves to keep the fire blazing while the flame-loving lizards scampered up and down the crumbling white-hot logs. The first divination lesson of the new term was much less fun. Professor Trelawney was now teaching them palmistry, and she lost no time in informing Harry that he had the shortest lifeline she had ever seen. It was defense against the dark arts that Harry was keen to get to. After his conversation with Wood, he wanted to get started on his anti-dementor lessons as soon as possible.
Ah, yes, said Lupin,
when Harry reminded him of his promise at the end of class.
Let me see. How about 8 o'clock on Thursday evening? The History of Magic classroom should be large enough. I'll have to think carefully about how we're going to do this. We can't bring a real Dementor into the castle to practice on.
Still looks ill, doesn't he?
Said Ron, as they walked down the corridor, heading to dinner.
What do you reckon's the matter with him?
There was a loud and impatient tch from behind them. It was Hermione, who had been sitting at the feet of a suit of armour, repacking her bag, which was so full of books it wouldn't close.
"And what are you tutting at us for?" said Ron irritably.
"Nothing," said Hermione in a lofty voice, heaving her bag back over her shoulder.
"Yes, you were," said Ron. "I said, I wonder what's wrong with Lupin, and you—" "Well, isn't it obvious?"
said Hermione, with a look of maddening superiority.
"If you don't want to tell us, don't," snapped Ron.
"Fine," said Hermione haughtily, and she marched off.
"She doesn't know," said Ron, staring resentfully after Hermione. "She's just trying to get us to talk to her again."
At 8 o'clock on Thursday evening, Harry left Gryffindor Tower for the History of Magic classroom. It was dark and empty when he arrived, but he lit the lamps with his wand and had waited only 5 minutes when Professor Lupin turned up, carrying a large packing case, which he heaved onto Professor Binns' desk.
"What's that?"
said Harry.
"Another boggart," said Lupin, stripping off his cloak. "I've been combing the castle ever since Tuesday, and very luckily I found this one lurking inside Mr. Filch's filing cabinet. It's the nearest we'll get to a real Dementor. The boggart will turn into a Dementor when he sees you, so we'll be able to practice on him. I can store him in my office when we're not using him. There's a cupboard under my desk he'll like."
"Okay," said Harry, trying to sound as though he wasn't apprehensive at all, and merely glad that Lupin had found such a good substitute for a real Dementor.
"So,"
Professor Lupin had taken out his own wand and indicated that Harry should do the same. "The spell I'm going to try to teach you is highly advanced magic, Harry, well beyond ordinary wizarding level. It is called the Patronus Charm."
"How does it work?"
said Harry nervously.
"Well, when it works correctly, it conjures up a Patronus," said Lupin, "which is a kind of anti-dementor, a guardian that acts as a shield between you and the Dementor."
Harry had a sudden vision of himself crouching behind a Hagrid-sized figure holding a large club. Professor Lupin continued,
"The Patronus is a kind of positive force,
a projection of the very things that the Dementor feeds upon, hope, happiness, the desire to survive. But it cannot feel despair, as real humans can, so the Dementors can't hurt it. But I must warn you, Harry, that the charm might be too advanced for you. Many qualified wizards have difficulty with it.
What does a Patronus look like? Said Harry curiously.
Each one is unique to the wizard who conjures it.
And how do you conjure it?
With an incantation, which will work only if you are concentrating with all your might on a single, very happy memory. Harry cast his mind about for a happy memory. Certainly nothing that had happened to him at the Dursleys was going to do. Finally, he settled on the moment when he had first ridden a broomstick.
Right,
he said, trying to recall as exactly as possible the wonderful soaring sensation of his stomach. The incantation is this, Lupin cleared his throat, Expecto Patronum.
Expecto Patronum, Harry repeated under his breath, Expecto Patronum.
Concentrating hard on your happy memory?
Oh, yeah,
said Harry, quickly forcing his thoughts back to that first broom ride.
Expecto Patrono.
No, Patronum. Sorry.
Expecto Patronum. Expecto Patronum.
Something whooshed suddenly out of the end of his wand. It looked like a wisp of silvery gas.
Did you see that?
Said Harry excitedly. Something happened.
Very good, said Lupin, smiling. Right, then. Ready to try it on a Dementor?
Yes, Harry said, gripping his wand very tightly and moving into the middle of the deserted classroom. He tried to keep his mind on flying, but something else kept intruding. Any second now he might hear his mother again, but he shouldn't think that, or he would hear her again, and he didn't want to. Or did he? Lupin grasped the lid of the packing case and pulled. A Dementor rose slowly from the box, its hooded face turned toward Harry, one glistening, scabbed hand gripping its cloak. The lamps around the classroom flickered and went out. The Dementor stepped from the box and started to sweep silently toward Harry, drawing a deep, rattling breath. A wave of piercing cold broke over him.
Expecto Patronum! Harry yelled. Expecto Patronum! Expecto...
But the classroom and the Dementor were dissolving. Harry was falling again through thick white fog, and his mother's voice was louder than ever, echoing inside his head.
Not Harry! Not Harry! Please, I'll do anything!
Stand aside! Stand aside, girl!
Harry?
Harry jerked back to life. He was lying flat on his back on the floor. The classroom lamps were alight again. He didn't have to ask what had happened.
Sorry,
he muttered, sitting up and feeling cold sweat trickling down behind his glasses.
"Are you all right?" said Lupin. "Yes."
Harry pulled himself up on one of the desks and leaned against it.
"Here," Lupin handed him a chocolate frog. "Eat this before we try again. I didn't expect you to do it your first time. In fact, I would have been astounded if you had."
"It's getting worse," Harry muttered, biting off the frog's head.
I could hear her louder that time, and him, Voldemort.
Lupin looked paler than usual.
Harry, if you don't want to continue, I will more than understand.
I do, said Harry fiercely, stuffing the rest of the chocolate frog into his mouth.
I've got to. What if the Dementors turn up at our match against Ravenclaw? I can't afford to fall off again. If we lose this game, we've lost the Quidditch Cup.
All right, then, said Lupin. You might want to select another memory, a happy memory, I mean, to concentrate on. That one doesn't seem to have been strong enough. Harry thought hard and decided his feelings when Gryffindor had won the house championship last year had definitely qualified as very happy. He gripped his wand tightly again and took up his position in the middle of the classroom.
Ready? Said Lupin, gripping the box lid.
Ready, said Harry, trying hard to fill his head with happy thoughts about Gryffindor winning, and not dark thoughts about what was going to happen when the box opened.
Go,
said Lupin, pulling off the lid. The room went icily cold and dark once more. The Dementor glided forward, drawing its breath. One rotting hand was extending toward Harry.
Expecto Patronum, Harry yelled. Expecto Patronum! Expecto Pat...
White fog obscured his senses. Big, blurred shapes were moving around him. Then came a new voice, a man's voice, shouting, panicking.
Lily, take Harry and go. It's him. Go, run. I'll hold him off.
The sounds of someone stumbling from a room, a door bursting open, a cackle of high-pitched laughter.
Harry? Harry? Wake up.
Lupin was tapping Harry hard on the face. This time it was a minute before Harry understood why he was lying on a dusty classroom floor.
I heard my dad, Harry mumbled. That's the first time I've ever heard him. He tried to take on Voldemort himself to give my mum time to run for it.
Harry suddenly realized that there were tears on his face mingling with the sweat. He bent his face as low as possible, wiping them off on his robes, pretending to do up his shoelace so that Lupin wouldn't see.
"You heard, James?" said Lupin in a strange voice. "Yeah."
Face dry, Harry looked up.
"Why, you didn't know my dad, did you?"
I did, as a matter of fact," said Lupin. "We were friends at Hogwarts. Listen, Harry, perhaps we should leave it here for tonight. This charm is ridiculously advanced. I shouldn't have suggested putting you through this."
"No," said Harry.
He got up again. "I'll have one more go. I'm not thinking of happy enough things. That's what it is. Hang on." He racked his brains. A really, really happy memory, one that he could turn into a good, strong Patronus. The moment when he'd first found out he was a wizard and would be leaving the Dursleys for Hogwarts. If that wasn't a happy memory, he didn't know what was. Concentrating very hard on how he had felt when he'd realized he'd be leaving Privet Drive, Harry got to his feet and faced the packing case once more.
"Ready?" said Lupin, who looked as though he were doing this against his better judgment. "Concentrating hard? All right. Go."
He pulled off the lid of the case for the third time, and the Dementor rose out of it. The room fell cold and dark.
"Expecto Patronum!" Harry bellowed. "Expecto Patronum! Expecto Patronum!"
The screaming inside Harry's head had started again, except this time it sounded as though it were coming from a badly tuned radio. Softer and louder and softer again, and he could still see the Dementor. It had halted. And then a huge silver shadow came bursting out of the end of Harry's wand to hover between him and the Dementor. And though Harry's legs felt like water, he was still on his feet, though for how much longer he wasn't sure.
"Ridiculous!"
roared Lupin, springing forward. There was a loud crack, and Harry's cloudy Patronus vanished along with the Dementor. He sank into a chair, feeling as exhausted as if he'd just run a mile, and felt his legs shaking. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Professor Lupin forcing the Boggart back into the packing case with his wand. It had turned into a silvery orb again.
"Excellent," Lupin said, striding over to where Harry sat. "Excellent, Harry. That was definitely a start."
"Can we have another go, just one more go?"
"Not now," said Lupin firmly. "You've had enough for one night. Here."
He handed Harry a large bar of Honey Duke's best chocolate.
"Eat the lot, or Madame Pomfrey will be after my blood. Same time next week."
"Okay," said Harry. He took a bite of the chocolate and watched Lupin extinguishing the lamps that had rekindled with the disappearance of the Dementor. A thought had just occurred to him.
"Professor Lupin," he said, "if you knew my dad, you must have known Sirius Black as well."
Lupin turned very quickly.
"What gives you that idea?" he said sharply. "Nothing. I mean, I just knew they were friends at Hogwarts, too."
Lupin's face relaxed.
"Yes, I knew him," he said shortly. "Or I thought I did. You'd better be off, Harry. It's getting late."
Harry left the classroom, walking along the corridor and around a corner, then took a detour behind a suit of armor and sank down on its plinth to finish his chocolate, wishing he hadn't mentioned Black, as Lupin was obviously not keen on the subject. Then Harry's thoughts wandered back to his mother and father. He felt drained and strangely empty, even though he was so full of chocolate. Terrible though it was to hear his parents' last moments replayed inside his head,
These were the only times Harry had heard their voices since he was a very small child. But he'd never be able to produce a proper Patronus if he half wanted to hear his parents again.
"They're dead," he told himself sternly. "They're dead, and listening to echoes of them won't bring them back. You'd better get a grip on yourself if you want that Quidditch cup."
He stood up, crammed the last bit of chocolate into his mouth, and headed back to Gryffindor Tower. Ravenclaw played Slytherin a week after the start of term. Slytherin won, though narrowly. According to Wood, this was good news for Gryffindor, who would take second place if they beat Ravenclaw too. He therefore increased the number of team practices to 5 a week. This meant that with Lupin's anti-dementor classes, which in themselves were more draining than 6 Quidditch practices, Harry had just 1 night a week to do all his homework. Even so, he wasn't showing the strain nearly as much as Hermione, whose immense workload finally seemed to be getting to her. Every night without fail, Hermione was to be seen in a corner of the common room, several tables spread with books, arithmancy charts, rune dictionaries, diagrams of muggles lifting heavy objects, and file upon file of extensive notes. She barely spoke to anybody, and snapped when she was interrupted.
"How's she doing it?"
Ron muttered to Harry one evening, as Harry sat finishing a nasty essay on undetectable poisons for Snape. Harry looked up. Hermione was barely visible behind a tottering pile of books.
"Doing what?"
"Getting to all her classes," Ron said. "I heard her talking to Professor Vector, that arithmancy witch, this morning. They were going on about yesterday's lesson. But Hermione can't have been there, because she was with us in Care of Magical Creatures. And Ernie Macmillan told me she's never missed a Muggle Studies class, but half of them are at the same time as Divination, and she's never missed one of them either."
Harry didn't have time to fathom the mystery of Hermione's impossible schedule at the moment. He really needed to get on with Snape's essay. 2 seconds later, however, he was interrupted again, this time by Wood.
"Bad news, Harry. I've just been to see Professor McGonagall about the firebolt. She, got a bit shirty with me. Told me I'd got my priorities wrong. Seemed to think I cared more about winning the cup than I do about you staying alive. Just because I told her I didn't care if it threw you off, as long as you caught the snitch first."
Wood shook his head in disbelief.
"Honestly, the way she was yelling at me, you'd think I'd said something terrible. Then I asked her how much longer she was going to keep it."
He screwed up his face and imitated Professor McGonagall's severe voice.
"As long as necessary, Wood.
I reckon it's time you ordered a new broom, Harry. There's an order form at the back of Witch Broomstick. You could get a Nimbus 2001 like Malfoy's got."
"I'm not buying anything Malfoy thinks is good," said Harry flatly.
January faded imperceptibly into February, with no change in the bitterly cold weather. The match against Ravenclaw was drawing nearer and nearer, but Harry still hadn't ordered a new broom. He was now asking Professor McGonagall for news of the firebolt after every transfiguration lesson. Ron standing hopefully at his shoulder, Hermione rushing past with her face averted.
"No, Potter, you can't have it back yet,"
Professor McGonagall told him the 12th time this happened, before he'd even opened his mouth.
"We've checked for most of the usual curses, but Professor Flitwick believes the broom might be carrying a hurling hex. I shall tell you once we've finished checking it. Now please, stop badgering me."
To make matters even worse, Harry's anti-dementor lessons were not going nearly as well as he had hoped. Several sessions on, he was able to produce an indistinct, silvery shadow every time the Boggart Dementor approached him, but his Patronus was too feeble to drive the Dementor away. All it did was hover like a semi-transparent cloud, draining Harry of energy as he fought to keep it there. Harry felt angry with himself, guilty about his secret desire to hear his parents' voices again. "You're expecting too much of yourself," said Professor Lupin sternly in their 4th week of practice. "For a 13-year-old wizard, even an indistinct Patronus is a huge achievement. You aren't passing out anymore, are you?"
"I thought a Patronus would charge the Dementors down or something," said Harry dispiritedly. "Make them disappear."
"The true Patronus does do that," said Lupin, but you've achieved a great deal in a very short space of time. If the Dementors put in an appearance at your next Quidditch match, you will be able to keep them at bay long enough to get back to the ground.
You said it's harder if there are loads of them, said Harry.
I have complete confidence in you, said Lupin, smiling. Here, you've earned a drink, something from the Three Broomsticks. You won't have tried it before.
He pulled two bottles out of his briefcase.
Butter beer, said Harry without thinking. Yeah, I like that stuff.
Lupin raised an eyebrow.
Oh, Ron and Hermione bought me some back from Hogsmeade.
Harry lied quickly.
I see, said Lupin, though he still looked slightly suspicious. Well, let's drink to a Gryffindor victory against Ravenclaw. Not that I'm supposed to take sides as a teacher, he added hastily.
They drank the butterbeer in silence until Harry voiced something he'd been wondering for a while.
What's under a Dementor's hood?
Professor Lupin lowered his bottle thoughtfully.
Well, the only people who really know are in no condition to tell us. You see, the Dementor lowers its hood only to use its last and worst weapon.
What's that?
They call it the Dementor's Kiss, said Lupin, with a slightly twisted smile. It's what Dementors do to those they wish to destroy utterly. I suppose there must be some kind of mouth under there, because they clamp their jaws upon the mouth of the victim and suck out his soul.
Harry accidentally spat out a bit of butterbeer.
What? They kill?
Oh, no, said Lupin. Much worse than that. You can exist without your soul, you know, as long as your brain and heart are still working. But you'll have no sense of self any more, no memory, no anything. There's no chance at all of recovery. You'll just exist as an empty shell, and your soul is gone forever, lost.
Lupin drank a little more butterbeer, then said, It's the fate that awaits Sirius Black. It was in the Daily Prophet this morning. The Ministry have given the Dementors permission to perform it if they find him.
Harry sat stunned for a moment at the idea of someone having their soul sucked out through their mouth, but then he thought of Black.
He deserves it, he said suddenly.
You think so? Said Lupin lightly. Do you really think anyone deserves that?
Yes, said Harry defiantly. For some things.
He would have liked to have told Lupin about the conversation he'd overheard about Black in the Three Broomsticks, about Black betraying his mother and father, but it would have involved revealing that he'd gone to Hogsmeade without permission, and he knew Lupin wouldn't be very impressed by that. So he finished his butterbeer, thanked Lupin, and left the History of Magic classroom. Harry half wished that he hadn't asked what was under a Dementor's hood. The answer had been so horrible, and he was so lost in unpleasant thoughts of what it would feel like to have your soul sucked out of you, that he walked headlong into Professor McGonagall halfway up the stairs.
Do watch where you're going, Potter.
Sorry, Professor.
I've been looking for you in the Gryffindor common room. Well, here it is. We've done everything we could think of, and there doesn't seem to be anything wrong with it at all. You've got a very good friend somewhere, Potter.
Harry's jaw dropped. She was holding out his firebolt, and it looked as magnificent as ever.
I can have it back, Harry said weakly. Seriously?
Seriously,
said Professor McGonagall, and she was actually smiling.
I dare say you need to get the feel of it before Saturday's match, won't you? And Potter, do try and win, won't you? Or we'll be out of the running for the 8th year in a row, as Professor Snape was kind enough to remind me only last night.
Speechless, Harry carried the firebolt back upstairs toward Gryffindor Tower. As he turned a corner, he saw Ron dashing toward him, grinning from ear to ear.
She gave it to you. Excellent. Listen, can I still have a go on it tomorrow?
Yeah, anything, said Harry, his heart lighter than it had been in a month.
You know what? We should make up with Hermione. She was only trying to help.
Yeah, all right, said Ron. She's in the common room now, working for a change. They turned into the corridor to Gryffindor Tower and saw Neville Longbottom pleading with Sir Cadogan, who seemed to be refusing him entrance.
I wrote them down, Neville was saying tearfully.
"But I must have dropped them somewhere." "A likely tale,"
roared Sir Cadogan, then spotting Harry and Ron.
"Good evening, my fine young yeoman. Come clap this loon in irons. He's trying to force entry into the chambers within."
"Oh, shut up," said Ron as he and Harry drew level with Neville.
"I've lost the passwords,"
Neville told them miserably.
"I made him tell me what passwords he was going to use this week because he keeps changing them, and now I don't know what I've done with them."
"Odds bodikins," said Harry to Sir Cadogan, who looked extremely disappointed and reluctantly swung forward to let them into the common room. There was a sudden excited murmur as every head turned, and the next moment Harry was surrounded by people exclaiming over his firebolt.
"Where'd you get it, Harry? Will you let me have a go?
Have you ridden it yet, Harry?
Ravenclaw will have no chance. They're all on clean sweep sevens. Can I just hold it, Harry?"
After 10 minutes or so, during which the firebolt was passed around and admired from every angle, the crowd dispersed, and Harry and Ron had a clear view of Hermione, the only person who hadn't rushed over to them, bent over her work and carefully avoiding their eyes. Harry and Ron approached her table, and at last she looked up.
"I got it back," said Harry, grinning at her and holding up the firebolt. "You see, Hermione, there wasn't anything wrong with it," said Ron. "Well, there might have been," said Hermione. "I mean, at least you know now that it's safe."
"Yeah, I suppose so," said Harry. "I'd better put it upstairs."
"I'll take it," said Ron eagerly. "I've got to give Scabbers his rat tonic."
He took the firebolt and, holding it as if it were made of glass, carried it away up the boys' staircase.
"Can I sit down then?"
Harry asked Hermione.
"I suppose so,"
said Hermione, moving a great stack of parchment off a chair. Harry looked around at the cluttered table, at the long arithmancy essay on which the ink was still glistening, at the even longer Muggle Studies essay, "Explain Why Muggles Need Electricity," and at the rune translation Hermione was now poring over.
"How are you getting through all this stuff?"
Harry asked her.
"Oh, well, you know, working hard,"
said Hermione. Close up, Harry saw that she looked almost as tired as Lupin. "Why don't you just drop a couple of subjects?" Harry asked, watching her lifting books as she searched for her rune dictionary.
"I couldn't do that,"
said Hermione, looking scandalized.
"Arithmancy looks terrible," said Harry, picking up a very complicated-looking number chart. "Oh, no, it's wonderful,"
said Hermione earnestly.
"It's my favorite subject. It's..."
But exactly what was wonderful about arithmancy, Harry never found out. At that precise moment, a strangled yell echoed down the boys' staircase. The whole common room fell silent, staring, petrified at the entrance. Then came hurried footsteps, growing louder and louder, and then Ron came leaping into view, dragging with him a bedsheet.
"Look!"
he bellowed, striding over to Hermione's table.
"Look!"
he yelled, shaking the sheets in her face.
"Ron, what? Scabbers! Look! Scabbers!"
Hermione was leaning away from Ron, looking utterly bewildered. Harry looked down at the sheet Ron was holding. There was something red on it, something that looked horribly like...
"Blood!"
Ron yelled into the stunned silence.
"He's gone! And you know what was on the floor?"
No, said Hermione in a trembling voice. Ron threw something down onto Hermione's rune translation. Hermione and Harry leaned forward. Lying on top of the weird, spiky shapes were several long ginger cat hairs. Chapter 13. Gryffindor versus Ravenclaw. It looked like the end of Ron and Hermione's friendship. Each was so angry with the other that Harry couldn't see how they'd ever make up. Ron was enraged that Hermione had never taken Crookshank's attempts to eat Scabbers seriously, hadn't bothered to keep a close enough watch on him, and was still trying to pretend that Crookshanks was innocent by suggesting that Ron look for Scabbers under all the boys' beds. Hermione, meanwhile, maintained fiercely that Ron had no proof that Crookshanks had eaten Scabbers, that the ginger hairs might have been there since Christmas, and that Ron had been prejudiced against her cat ever since Crookshanks had landed on Ron's head in the magical menagerie. Personally, Harry was sure that Crookshanks had eaten Scabbers, and when he tried to point out to Hermione that the evidence all pointed that way, she lost her temper with Harry too.
Okay, side with Ron. I knew you would, she said shrilly. First the firebolt, now Scabbers. Everything's my fault, isn't it? Just leave me alone, Harry. I've got a lot of work to do.
Ron had taken the loss of his rat very hard indeed.
Come on, Ron. You were always saying how boring Scabbers was, said Fred bracingly. And he's been off colour for ages. He was wasting away. It was probably better for him to snuff it quickly. One swallow. He probably didn't feel a thing. Fred, said Ginny indignantly. All he did was eat and sleep, Ron. You said it yourself, said George. He bit Goyle for us once, Ron said miserably. Remember, Harry?
Yeah, that's true, said Harry.
His finest hour, said Fred, unable to keep a straight face. Let the scar on Goyle's finger stand as a lasting tribute to his memory. Oh, come on, Ron. Get yourself down to Hogsmeade and buy a new rat. What's the point of moaning?
In a last-ditch attempt to cheer Ron up, Harry persuaded him to come along to the Gryffindor team's final practice before the Ravenclaw match, so that he could have a ride on the Firebolt after they'd finished. This did seem to take Ron's mind off Scabbers for a moment.
Great! Can I try and shoot a few goals on it?
So they set off for the Quidditch field together. Madam Hooch, who was still overseeing Gryffindor practices to keep an eye on Harry, was just as impressed with the Firebolt as everyone else had been. She took it in her hands before takeoff and gave them the benefit of her professional opinion.
Look at the balance on it. If the Nimbus series has a fault, it's a slight list to the tail end. You often find them develop a drag after a few years. They've updated the handle, too. A bit slimmer than the clean sweeps. Reminds me of the old silver arrows. A pity they've stopped making them. I learned to fly on one, and a very fine old broom it was, too.
She continued in this vein for some time, until Wood said,
Madam Hooch, is it okay if Harry has the firebolt back? We need to practice.
Ooh, right. Here you are then, Potter,
said Madam Hooch.
I'll sit over here with Weasley.
She and Ron left the field to sit in the stadium, and the Gryffindor team gathered around Wood for his final instructions for tomorrow's match.
Harry, I've just found out who Ravenclaw is playing as Seeker. It's Cho Chang. She's a fourth year, and she's pretty good. I really hope she wouldn't be fit. She's had some problems with injuries.
Wood scowled his displeasure that Cho Chang had made a full recovery, then said, On the other hand, she rides a Comet 260, which is going to look like a joke next to the Firebolt. He gave Harry's broom a look of fervent admiration, then said, Okay, everyone, let's go. And at long last, Harry mounted his firebolt and kicked off from the ground. It was better than he'd ever dreamed. The firebolt turned with the lightest touch. It seemed to obey his thoughts rather than his grip. It sped across the field at such speed that the stadium turned into a green and grey blur. Harry turned it so sharply that Alicia Spinett screamed. Then he went into a perfectly controlled dive, brushing the grassy field with his toes before rising 30, 40, 50 feet into the air again.
"Harry, I'm letting the snitch out!"
Wood called. Harry turned and raced a bludger toward the goalposts. He outstripped it easily, saw the snitch dart out from behind Wood, and within 10 seconds had caught it tightly in his hand. The team cheered madly. Harry let the snitch go again, gave it a minute's head start, then tore after it, weaving in and out of the others. He spotted it lurking near Katie Bell's knee, looped her easily, and caught it again. It was the best practice ever. The team, inspired by the presence of the firebolt in their midst, performed their best moves faultlessly, and by the time they hit the ground again, Wood didn't have a single criticism to make, which, as George Weasley pointed out, was a first.
"I can't see what's going to stop us tomorrow," said Wood. "Not unless, Harry, you've sorted out your Dementor problem, haven't you?"
"Yeah," said Harry, thinking of his feeble Patronus and wishing it was stronger.
"The Dementors won't turn up again, Oliver. Dumbledore would go ballistic," said Fred confidently. "Well, let's hope not," said Wood. "Anyway, good work, everyone. Let's get back to the tower. Turn in early."
"I'm staying out for a bit. Ron wants a go on the firebolt," Harry told Wood. And while the rest of the team headed off to the locker rooms, Harry strode over to Ron, who vaulted the barrier to the stands and came to meet him. Madam Hooch had fallen asleep in her seat.
"Here you go," said Harry, handing Ron the firebolt.
Ron, an expression of ecstasy on his face, mounted the broom and zoomed off into the gathering darkness while Harry walked around the edge of the field, watching him. Night had fallen before Madame Hooch awoke with a start, told Harry and Ron off for not waking her, and insisted that they go back to the castle. Harry shouldered the firebolt, and he and Ron walked out of the shadowy stadium, discussing the firebolt's superbly smooth action, its phenomenal acceleration, and its pinpoint turning. They were halfway toward the castle when Harry, glancing to his left, saw something that made his heart turn over. A pair of eyes, gleaming out of the darkness. Harry stopped dead, his heart banging against his ribs.
"What's the matter?" said Ron.
Harry pointed. Ron pulled out his wand and muttered, "Lumos!" A beam of light fell across the grass, hit the bottom of a tree, and illuminated its branches. There, crouching among the budding leaves, was Crookshanks.
"Get out of here!"
Ron roared, and he stooped down and seized a stone lying on the grass. But before he could do anything else, Crookshanks had vanished with one swish of his long ginger tail.
"See?"
Ron said furiously, chucking the stone down again.
"She's still letting him wander about wherever he wants. Probably washing down scabbers with a couple of birds now."
Harry didn't say anything. He took a deep breath as relief seeped through him. He had been sure for a moment that those eyes had belonged to the Grimm. They set off for the castle once more. Slightly ashamed of his moment of panic, Harry didn't say anything to Ron, nor did he look left or right until they had reached the well-lit entrance hall. Harry went down to breakfast the next morning with the rest of the boys in his dormitory, all of whom seemed to think the firebolt deserved a sort of guard of honor. As Harry entered the great hall, heads turned in the direction of the firebolt, and there was a good deal of excited muttering. Harry saw, with enormous satisfaction, that the Slytherin team were all looking thunderstruck.
"Did you see his face?"
said Ron gleefully, looking back at Malfoy.
"He can't believe it. This is brilliant."
Wood, too, was basking in the reflected glory of the firebolt.
"Put it here, Harry,"
he said, laying the broom in the middle of the table and carefully turning it so that its name faced upward. People from the Ravenclaw and Hufflepuff tables were soon coming over to look. Cedric Diggory came over to congratulate Harry on having acquired such a superb replacement for his Nimbus, and Percy's Ravenclaw girlfriend, Penelope Clearwater, asked if she could actually hold the firebolt.
Now, Penny, no sabotage,"
said Percy heartily as she examined the firebolt closely.
"Penelope and I have got a bet on,"
he told the team.
10 galleons on the outcome of the match."
Penelope put the firebolt down again, thanked Harry, and went back to her table.
"Harry, make sure you win," said Percy in an urgent whisper. "I haven't got 10 galleons. "Yes, I'm coming, Penny."
And he bustled off to join her in a piece of toast.
"Sure you can manage that broom, Potter," said a cold, drawling voice.
Draco Malfoy had arrived for a closer look, Crabbe and Goyle right behind him.
"Yeah, reckon so," said Harry casually.
"Got plenty of special features, hasn't it?"
said Malfoy, eyes glittering maliciously.
"Shame it doesn't come with a parachute, in case you get too near a Dementor."
Crabbe and Goyle sniggered.
"Pity you can't attach an extra arm to yours, Malfoy," said Harry.
"Then it could catch the snitch for you." The Gryffindor team laughed loudly. Malfoy's pale eyes narrowed and he stalked away. They watched him rejoin the rest of the Slytherin team, who put their heads together, no doubt asking Malfoy whether Harry's broom really was a firebolt. At 11:15, the Gryffindor team set off for the locker rooms. The weather couldn't have been more different from their match against Hufflepuff. It was a clear, cool day with a very light breeze. There would be no visibility problems this time, and Harry, though nervous, was starting to feel the excitement only a Quidditch match could bring. They could hear the rest of the school moving into the stadium beyond. Harry took off his black school robes, removed his wand from his pocket, and stuck it inside the T-shirt he was going to wear under his Quidditch robes. He only hoped he wouldn't need it. He wondered suddenly whether Professor Lupin was in the crowd watching.
"You know what we've got to do," said Wood as they prepared to leave the locker rooms. "If we lose this match,
We're out of the running. Just fly like you did in practice yesterday, and we'll be okay.
They walked out onto the field to tumultuous applause. The Ravenclaw team, dressed in blue, were already standing in the middle of the field. Their seeker, Cho Chang, was the only girl on their team. She was shorter than Harry by about a head, and Harry couldn't help noticing, nervous as he was, that she was extremely pretty. She smiled at Harry as the teams faced each other behind their captains, and he felt a slight lurch in the region of his stomach that he didn't think had anything to do with nerves.
"Wood, Davis, shake hands,"
Madam Hooch said briskly, and Wood shook hands with the Ravenclaw captain.
"Mount your brooms, on my whistle, 3, 2, 1.
Harry kicked off into the air, and the firebolt zoomed higher and faster than any other broom. He soared around the stadium and began squinting around for the snitch, listening all the while to the commentary, which was being provided by the Weasley twins' friend, Lee Jordan.
"They're off, and the big excitement this match is the firebolt that Harry Potter is flying for Gryffindor. According to Witch Broomstick, the firebolt's going to be the broom of choice for the national teams at this year's World Championship."
"Jordan, would you mind telling us what's going on in the match?"
interrupted Professor McGonagall's voice.
"Right you are, Professor. Just giving a bit of background information.
The firebolt, incidentally, has a built-in auto-brake and...
Jordan!"
"Okay, okay. Gryffindor in possession. Katie Boyle of Gryffindor heading for goal."
Harry streaked past Katie in the opposite direction, gazing around for a glint of gold and noticing that Cho Chang was tailing him closely. She was undoubtedly a very good flyer. She kept cutting across him, forcing him to change direction.
"Show her your acceleration, Harry!"
Fred yelled as he whooshed past in pursuit of a bludger that was aiming for Alicia. Harry urged the firebolt forward as they rounded the Ravenclaw goalposts, and Cho fell behind. Just as Katie succeeded in scoring the first goal of the match and the Gryffindor end of the field went wild, he saw it. The snitch was close to the ground, flitting near one of the barriers. Harry dived. Cho saw what he was doing and tore after him. Harry was speeding up, excitement flooding him. Dives were his speciality. He was 10 feet away. Then a bludger, hit by one of the Ravenclaw beaters, came pelting out of nowhere. Harry veered off course, avoiding it by an inch, and in those few crucial seconds, the snitch had vanished. There was a great "ooh" of disappointment from the Gryffindor supporters, but much applause for their beater from the Ravenclaw end. George Weasley vented his feelings by hitting the second bludger directly at the offending beater, who was forced to roll right over in midair to avoid it.
"Gryffindor leads by 80 points to 0, and look at that firebolt go. Potter's really putting it through its paces now. See it turn. Chang's comet is just no match for it. The firebolt's precision balance is really noticeable in these long..."
"Jordan! Are you being paid to advertise firebolts? Get on with the commentary!"
Ravenclaw was pulling back. They had now scored 3 goals, which put Gryffindor only 50 points ahead. If Cho got the snitch before him, Ravenclaw would win. Harry dropped lower, narrowly avoiding a Ravenclaw chaser, scanning the field frantically. A glint of gold, a flutter of tiny wings. The snitch was circling the Gryffindor goalpost. Harry accelerated, eyes fixed on the speck of gold ahead, but just then Cho appeared out of thin air, blocking him.
"Harry, this is no time to be a gentleman,"
Wood roared as Harry swerved to avoid a collision.
"Knock her off her broom if you have to."
Harry turned and caught sight of Cho. She was grinning. The snitch had vanished again. Harry turned his firebolt upward and was soon 20 feet above the game. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Cho following him. She decided to mark him rather than search for the snitch herself. All right, then. If she wanted to tail him, she'd have to take the consequences. He dived again, and Cho, thinking he'd seen the snitch, tried to follow. Harry pulled out of the dive very sharply. She hurtled downward. He rose fast as a bullet once more, and then saw it for the third time. The snitch was glittering way above the field at the Ravenclaw end. He accelerated. So, many feet below, did Cho. He was winning, gaining on the snitch with every second. Then,
"Oh!"
screamed Cho, pointing. Distracted, Harry looked down. Three Dementors, three tall, black, hooded Dementors, were looking up at him. He didn't stop to think. Plunging a hand down the neck of his robes, he whipped out his wand and roared, "Expecto Patronum!" Something silver-white, something enormous, erupted from the end of his wand. He knew it.